Good afternoon. This working? Can you hear me back there?
Yeah.
Sounds funny.
No.
How about this? Well, I have the honor of introducing today's speaker. My problem is that I introduced him yesterday, and I don't want to repeat everything I said. It would really be helpful for me to know how many people are here and weren't here yesterday. Oh, my. Okay, so I will proceed with the... I was just going to say, so here he is again, but... in this case, I will introduce him, and with apologies to those who were here yesterday. Professor Marmot is a Hitchcock professor. The Hitchcock Fund, I'm reading from my instructions, is one of the most cherished endowments of the University of California, encouraging recognition of the highest distinction in scholarly thought and achievement. Established by Dr. Charles Hitchcock in 1885 to institute a professorship at the University of California. And you can see from your program the list of truly distinguished people who have been awarded this professorship. In your program also is an evaluation form, which I've been asked to remind you to fill out and leave when you leave the auditorium. I first learned of Michael Marmot in 1970, when I was giving a lecture in New Zealand. I was talking about the work we were doing in social epidemiology at Berkeley, and at the end, this man came up to me and said, I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Sydney. We have this medical student. He's a senior medical student, the best student in our school, but he's driving us crazy. He questions everything. He wants to know what the evidence is in support of everything we say, always challenging the things we're saying. Would you take him at Berkeley if he came for a postdoc? I said, sure. And I didn't take it seriously, but sure enough, next year he showed up with his wife, Alexi. He got an MPH and then got his PhD at Berkeley studying the Japanese migration from Japan to Hawaii to California. And his wife subsequently received her PhD in city and regional planning from Berkeley. But it was clear from the time when I met his professor of medicine that this guy was a troublemaker, and he has been a troublemaker ever since. When he left Berkeley, he went to London. He has served as professor of epidemiology and public health at University College in London, and he is director of the Center for Health and Society there. The main focus of his work over the years has been on the health of the underserved, on inequality, on injustice, and he's really had a remarkable and distinguished career. One of the main problems we have in public health is the fact that poor people have the highest rates of virtually every disease we know about. This has been known since the beginning of recorded history. And it's not it's something we all know, but it's been very difficult to get a handle on what to do about this. Because poor people they have low income and low education and bad housing and bad health care and bad nutrition. It's a long list of things that characterize people at the bottom, and it's almost impossible to disentangle these and figure out what's more important than anything else. Michael's work has changed all of that. His work with the British civil servants, which he'll talk about, has really revolutionized our understanding of this entire problem, so that now the United States government, in the form of NIH, has major initiatives in this area. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has launched a brand new program. The Canadian government is reorganizing their institutes. The United Kingdom is doing it. Australia. It's been a major impact throughout the world based on his work, that the issue of inequalities is now on everyone's agenda, and there are things we can do about it. He's been honored as a consultant to the Philippines and China and Pakistan and Poland and other places. It's really been a remarkable record of achievement. So here's this troublemaker who has really made a tremendous difference. And the most confounding thing is that he's been honored by, for example, one of the most conservative groups in the entire world is the Medical Research Council of England. And they gave the troublemaker a lifetime professorship. And then the Queen knighted him in the year 2000. We also, in the School of Public Health, voted him as the outstanding alumnus that year. I should say, with regard to the knightship, that we need to take this with a grain of salt. As he points out, he was offered knighted by the Queen in the same year that Elizabeth Taylor and Sean Connery were. So we need to keep this in perspective. Anyway, it's a true honor and a privilege to introduce Michael to you, and I do so now. Michael.
Thank you again, Len. I won't repeat all my thanks to the Hitchcock Committee that I did yesterday, but I will just say a word apropos knighthood and the contradiction of being knighted. The citation for my knighthood said, "For services to epidemiology and understanding health inequalities," and the idea of having your status increased because you spent your life studying health inequalities, and a colleague of mine said that we should have a competition of what you should say to Her Majesty the Queen should she ask you what are health inequalities. And his entry into the competition was, "You should say, your mother is 100, ma'am." It's a matter of great regret to me that she didn't ask me that question. Perhaps I'll tell you some other time what did happen, but I've entitled the second lecture of these two, "There Is Such a Thing as Society." This pays homage to another famous British lady, Margaret Thatcher, who famously said, "There is no such thing as society. There are only individuals and families." By the time she was finished with this, it was almost true that there was... there is such a thing as society. And before I launch into this second half, yesterday I posed a problem, and today I want to give you my attempt at a solution. Given the show of hands of people who were not here yesterday, I could ask you to behave like evolutionary psychologists who start with a solution and work out what the problem was. So I could ask you at the end of today's lecture, what was the problem I was attempting to solve? Or alternatively, I could be kind and I could try and just very briefly summarize what I said yesterday. And so I will. What I did was talk about the social gradient in health, and the fact that I said we're all born equal, but some are more equal than others, and that's true of health. There's a social gradient, but I said that it should not be thought of simply as them, the poor, with poor health, and us, the non-poor, with good health, but it was a gradient. It goes from the top to the bottom of society. I then referred to the fact that we see social gradients both in the organization of society, but social gradients in health in non-human primates. And that gave me pause. If we see social gradients in all primate societies, non-human as well as human, why should I think we could do anything about the problem? And I suggested there were two approaches. One was, potentially, we could change the social gradient in society, but if all societies have social gradients, that didn't seem very promising. Or we could try and understand what the link was between position in society and illness, and we could try and interrupt those links. Somebody in the audience asked me why I was so pessimistic about trying to change the social gradient, and I was thinking about it overnight, and I remembered Amartya Sen's description of an optimist. An optimist is someone who thinks that the present organization of society is the best that could possibly be. And a pessimist is one who fears that may very well be the case. Actually, the Jewish definition, a pessimist is someone who thinks things can't get any worse, and an optimist says, oh yes, they can. But I'm an optimist in the original meaning of the word. I think we can do something about this problem. And I pointed out that understanding individual differences in health was not the same as trying to understand differences between groups or between societies. There may be different sets of explanations. I pointed out that we've been thinking about the same sorts of explanations for 100 years or more, and I went through why I didn't think this was all to do with medical care, why it was not the case that poor genetic constitution leads to poor health and poor health leads to low social status. And I then started to think about money, status, and power as explanations of the relation between social position and health. Those of you who weren't here yesterday may wonder how I managed to fill an hour when I've actually said everything I have to say in about 4 minutes. My conclusion was, in thinking about money, that money was very important to health if you haven't got any. But above a threshold of absolute deprivation, money per se, income per se, was not the crucial issue. What was important was that income was correlated with social position, and it was something about social position that was important. And part of my argument in support of that, and I'll come back to that today, part of my argument in support of that is that there are poor societies with very low income, but remarkably good health. And I finished with a quote from Amartya Sen about relative and absolute, but I want to come back to that today. So that's the story till now. So today's lecture, I want to start with thinking about equality of what? What is it we want equality of? And I want to contrast two positions: Rawls' justice as fairness and Amartya Sen's equal capabilities. I was at a seminar at Harvard three years ago. It was in fact the year Amartya Sen won the Nobel Prize, because he was the one who'd convened this seminar and had invited me, but he'd won the prize about 3 weeks before the seminar, and he kept disappearing out of the room at crucial moments. And I can only imagine that he was talking to senators or presidents or whatever people do when that happens. But the striking thing for me about this seminar, there were a lot of philosophers there, and they were all devotees of John Rawls. And they were all talking about fairness in distribution. When I said I was interested in outcomes, I was interested in health, they had a terrible word to describe such a lapse, such a moral lapse. I was a consequentialist. I'd never heard such a horrible insult. It's what an epithet. I went home and I said to a philosopher colleague, I think I'm a consequentialist. And he said, oh no, you're far too nice a person for that. I said, you're going to have to tell me what all this is about. He said, well, a consequentialist believes that the end justifies the means. I said, well, I don't know about that, but I'm interested in health outcomes. I think if you just distribute resources equally or fairly, but they don't lead to equal outcomes, that's not a good situation. I said, for example, we know, and the evidence is clear, that if you have equal expenditure per capita on education, then children from middle-class families will do better than children from poor families. So there's a fair distribution of resources, but it doesn't actually give us an outcome that I personally think is very desirable. It gives us unequal outcome in terms of education. Now, how do I know that that isn't a distribution of resources that I would like without regard to the consequence, the outcome? Well, what does that make me if not a consequentialist? And my philosopher colleague says, that's common sense. Well, okay. But I think there is an issue, though, and people can correct me. If somebody is a devotee of Rawls, I'd be very grateful to be corrected afterwards. But if you think of these two graphs, which are artificially constructed, but they're not that different from real data. Mortality rate here and social position, high and low. This is position one. Mortality rate is higher, but there's a relatively shallow social gradient. Now, position two, everybody's mortality has come down, But the mortality of the high classes has come down the most. And in fact, the degree of reduction in mortality was proportional to your social position. I think a Rawlsian would say that this yellow line is more desirable, is fairer than the red line, because the difference principle in Rawls' theory suggests that any distribution that favors the least well-off, or the distribution that most favors the least well-off, is the fairest. Well, I can't sign up to that, I'm afraid. When asked by a colleague, well, which of these would I prefer? And I said, neither. I won't sign up to either of those. I don't like that choice. And I'm not comfortable with saying that this position of greater inequality in health, in mortality, is a fairer position, which I think would be a Rawls position, than this one. Obviously, what I think we want is we want to move that red line down. We want everybody to come down. And ideally, we would like to flatten it somewhat so that the inequality is reduced. And I think that corresponds more closely to an Amartya Sen-type position where he is interested in consequences. In his case, he's concerned with capabilities. And this was the quote I ended my lecture yesterday, with which I ended my lecture yesterday. Relative deprivation in the space of incomes can yield absolute deprivation in the space of capabilities. In other words, if you're relatively poorly off in respect to income, that's a relative position. And given that incomes will always be unequally distributed, there will always be some people who are relatively worse off than others with respect to income. The question is, how does that translate into capabilities? And what do we mean by capabilities? Well, that's what I want now to explore. And in thinking about how important income inequality is, and I apologize for this, but I was rude to economists yesterday, so I may as well be consistent. It comes from some economists. What income inequality might mean, I've made the egregious assumption, the outrageous assumption, that happiness might be something worth measuring and that it might correlate with capabilities. And what this has done, and I've tried to make something that was close to impenetrable, just only moderately impenetrable, this is looking, comparing Europeans and Americans, and it's looking at the effect of income inequality on happiness. So a one standard deviation increase in the Gini coefficient. The Gini coefficient is a measure of income inequality. So a one standard deviation increase in the Gini means increased inequality. And increased inequality results in a decrease in happiness amongst Europeans, but no change amongst Americans. Americans seem to be much more tolerant, if you believe these data, of income inequalities than are Europeans. And if you, so that's for all people. If you look at poor people, then poor people in Europe are particularly intolerant of increases in income inequalities. Their happiness declines even more. Poor people in the United States, no impact on unhappiness. Americans would appear are much more tolerant of income inequalities. Except for this group, the group who are rich and of the left politically, most of whom are probably in this room, who are particularly intolerant in the US of income inequalities. So there is some suggestion, if you allow me this outrageous assumption that happiness might be something that related to capabilities, that income inequalities might be more important in Europe than they are in the United States. It might also account for the fact that income inequalities have grown faster in the United States than they have in most European countries, because Americans in general seem to be more tolerant of them. So, relative position in health, how does it operate? And I want to consider these possibilities. Let's start with power. And this was the model that I showed you yesterday, social structure, the work, social environment, psychological influences, health behaviors, there are material factors there, effects on the brain, pathophysiological changes, well-being, mortality, morbidity, early life, plays out on a genetic substrate and cultural differences. And one way we've been looking at power relations is in the workplace. And we look at the degree of control people have over their work. This is from our Whitehall 2 study of British civil servants, men and women, high job control, intermediate job control, and low job control. And this is a rate ratio for incidence of coronary heart disease. And you can see that people with low job control have about twice the incidence of coronary disease compared to those with high job control. Here, the whatever color that is, pink, we've controlled for effort-reward imbalance, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And here we've controlled for employment grade and the standard coronary risk factors and negative affect as some control on reporting bias, and that appears to make very little difference. Now, having controlled for grade of employment, of course, low control is more frequent as you go down the hierarchy. And in fact, low control in the workplace appears to make an important contribution to the social gradient in coronary heart disease incidence. Effort-reward imbalance is the other way we've been looking at the workplace. The balance between how much effort you put out and how much reward you get. And I was showing these data to the president of University College London, and I said, low effort, high reward, that's the president. High effort and low reward, they're department chairs. He said, that's the way it ought to be. And people with high effort and low reward had more than twice the incidence of coronary disease, independent of low control. So low control predicted independent of effort-reward imbalance. Effort-reward imbalance predicted independent of low control. The other thing we've been looking at in the workplace is job insecurity. So not just circumstances at work, but fear of losing your job. And again, this is from the Whitehall 2 study, women and men, poor health and depression, women and men. And these are people who remained secure, and we take them arbitrarily as having a rate of 100. These are the people who gained job security, so they were insecure and got a bit more secure. These are the people who lost job security and chronic job insecurity. So job insecurity over a 2.5 year period was related to a greater likelihood of poor health in women and men, and similarly, job insecurity was related to depression in women and men. Work casts a long shadow. What happens in the workplace, of course, is important for wider aspects of life. People develop their self-esteem, their autonomy, their income, their place in society at work, and people in low status at work are likely to occupy low status in society. And so it can, of course, be difficult to separate out the effects of work from the wider effects of position in society. We were discussing at lunchtime today one of the reasons that I, in my Whitehall 2 studies, have focused on the workplace is because it gives one a potential handle for change. Social participation. I actually want to distinguish two aspects of the social environment and treat them slightly separately. And that's why I've called them social participation and social environment, although on my model, I've just put them as social environment. Now, one aspect of social participation is participation in social networks, the social support. One obvious social network is marriage. Marital status. And these are data from the Czech Republic for men, and it shows that married men have a lower mortality than average, but single, divorced, and widowed have a higher mortality than average. And this is well known from lots of data. The reason I'm showing to you here is between 1960 and 1990, the disadvantage of being unmarried increased. And for those who weren't here yesterday, what I showed yesterday was over this period of time, life expectancy declined, mortality increased, and life expectancy declined in the Czech Republic as it did in all the countries of Central and Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And that increased mortality was greater in the unmarried. They seemed to be peculiarly sensitive to whatever it was that was causing the increase in mortality. And we see it persisting, that increased disadvantage of the unmarried, into the 90s. Interestingly, the disadvantage of being unmarried is much bigger for men than for women. And again, that's been well known, but this increasing disadvantage for men, and I was puzzling over this, and I asked Kathy Newman, who's an anthropologist, how she explained it. And the answer was, if you look at the command economy under the communist system, women worked the informal networks, bartering, trading in the grey economy or the black economy to get food, to feed the family, services and so on. And they were networked. If a man loses his wife, he loses his network. If a woman loses a husband, it's just one fewer problem to deal with and she can get on with the rest of it. But I want to think about participation more generally. I've already quoted two economists, Robert Fogel and Amartya Sen. Let me quote a third great economist, the father of it all, Adam Smith. By necessaries, I understand not only the commodities which are indispensably necessary for the support of life, but whatever the customs of the country renders it indecent for creditable people, even the lowest order, to be without. And he goes on to say that a creditable person of the lowest order would be ashamed to appear in public without a linen shirt. The Greeks and Romans, I suppose, says Adam Smith, got by quite comfortably without a linen shirt. Similarly, no self-respecting day laborer would appear in public without leather shoes. The importance of material conditions are not just because they give us clean sewage and enough food to eat, but they allow us to participate fully in society. Now, after he wrote this about linen shirts, of course, the bottom dropped out of the linen market and cotton coming in from India, and so the whole thing changed. But the point being that having certain material goods is a criterion of taking your place fully in society, without which you are not a creditable member of society. And in thinking about this extra gloss on what it means to have material goods, still pursuing our studies in Central and Eastern Europe, we have data from Poland and from Hungary along these lines. And we asked people what household assets they had. What have you got in your household? And somewhat arbitrarily, we divided these household assets into what we called basic household assets, and then two other categories that I'll show you in a moment. And in the basic, we included a washing machine, a fridge, a freezer, a microwave, and a phone. And the idea being that without these things, life really is physically much harder. And our health outcome was poor health. And the more assets people had, the less likely they were to be in poor health. Here we've adjusted for age, sex, education, marital status, education, and other measures of material deprivation. So it was consistent with our first thought that these were, in a sense, basic assets without which you were materially deprived, and it was consistent with saying that material deprivation is bad for health. So that was our first category of household assets. Our second category was what we called socially oriented items: a color television, a stereo system, a motorbike, a car radio. It's hard to say that you're materially deprived in some absolute sense without these, but they may be important for social participation. The more assets people had, the better their health, the less likely they were to report themselves in poor health. And adjusting for education, marital status, and material deprivation did not make that association go away, although it reduced it slightly. The third category was luxury items. Cable television, satellite television. My 15-year-old son does not think these are luxury items and feels materially deprived that we don't have them in the household. Video recorder, or camcorder, CD, a personal computer, dishwasher, a dasher, a country house. So these are luxury items. You cannot allege, even to my 15-year-old son, without these you are materially deprived. And the more items people had, the better the health. And it's a striking relationship with good health, and adjusting for material deprivation education didn't make it go away. Now this is entirely consistent with the Amartya Sen, Adam Smith notion that relative deprivation in one space, the space of income, might relate to absolute deprivation in another space. In this state, Sen calls it capabilities, I'll call it participation, following Adam Smith. And I think participation is actually absolutely vital for good health. And if we ask what poverty means today, this is from a survey called Breadline Europe, and this is from the British data, asking people, surveying people in the population, what would it mean to be poor? And these are the sorts of answers we get. Not having clothes for special occasions, like a job interview or a family celebration. Not having money for a family celebration. Not having the opportunity for leisure activities, not being able to afford a holiday from home, not being able to afford having friends round for tea, very English, not being able to afford children's toys, or not taking children swimming. This is what it means to be poor. This is social participation. This is relative to the mores and the norms of society at a given moment. This is not to do with material deprivation in the sense of malnutrition or unhealthy water. And thinking more about the fact that we're not dealing simply with income, I must have said something he didn't like, but that we're not dealing simply with income, let me show you another example of a poor community with good health, the well-known example of Kerala, a state in southern India. This is infant mortality by state in India. Kerala, 17 per thousand, and then ranking other Indian states from the poorest to the richest, it goes from 88 to 65. This is the gross national product of the top quarter of Indian states, $1,900 per capita, and Kerala is down near the bottom with $1,144. So it's one of the poorest states in India, but it has infant mortality of 17 compared with somewhere between 65 and 88 for the others. Now, how did it achieve such a low infant mortality and low mortality in general, high life expectancy? This is life expectancy for men in India, 57.7, Kerala, 66.8, compared with, at that time, 96, USA for 73, and women, females, 72.3 versus 79. Kerala doesn't look like one of the poorest states in India in terms of its infant mortality and life expectancy. If we look at female literacy, 66% of women in Kerala were classified as having acceptable literacy levels, compared with 15, 31, 36, 27, 15, 11 in other Indian states. Very high participation of women in education and literacy. The proportion of females who are married under age 18, 3% in Kerala were married under age 18, when it was up to a third in other states. So the status of women is really very important. High status of women in Kerala compared with other Indian states. Interestingly, the number of villages with medical facilities was actually amongst the lowest in Kerala compared with other Indian states. It didn't obviously look like they had better access to medical care. Far more important seemed to be female literacy and the general status of women. And we were told this charming story by a colleague from Kerala who said that in a factory, regrettably making cigarettes, but I'll leave that aside. In a factory, they pay one person to read to the others while they're working. So all these factory workers sit there, and there's one chap who's actually paid to read, and they take it in turns. And it seemed to me one definition of social capital and social participation. Now, I want to look at another aspect of the social environment, and I showed you this yesterday. And in showing it to you, I pointed out that this was a measure of income inequality. High scores here mean more egalitarian income. Low scores mean more unequal income. And these are states of the United States. And you see this fairly clear inverse association. The higher the equality of income, the lower the mortality. And this was Canada. Now, the question, though, is what does this mean? Is it income per se? Or is it, as I suspect, that income inequality is some marker for the social environment? Angus Deaton at Princeton has looked at these same data, and he shows that if you put the percent black in the model, then it correlates very highly with mortality in whites. And that these states here, Louisiana and Mississippi, for example, Alabama, all have high percent black, and white mortality in those states is high. I said to him, what does percent black mean? Why should that correlate with white mortality? What are you getting at here? And his answer is, well, I'm not sure, you're the epidemiologist, but I'm only an economist. But I think it's a marker of the social environment. Well, I think that's what income inequality is too. It's not, doesn't necessarily relate to income inequality per se. As another way of looking at the social environment, Andrea Cornia looked at regions in Russia, and he looked at the change in mortality in 12 Russian regions. And this is the change in male life expectancy, 1989 to 93, and so a drop here means a drop in life expectancy. And he classified regions of Russia by what he called stress caused by unexpected situations. And he used some rather simple markers, the unemployment rate, labor market turnover, change in the marriage and the divorce rate. And the higher these were, he said, the higher the stress caused by unexpected situations. And you can see that the higher the score on that stress marker, the greater the drop in life expectancy for the region. So you see this correlation. In thinking about the fact that income inequality might be a marker for the social environment, we need to take note of the fact that areas with high income inequality not only have high mortality, but have high crime rates, and the potential partnership between the Grim Reaper and social disruption. What about behavior? Why have I not mentioned anything to do with behavior? We so often hear that the diseases from which we suffer today are to do with lifestyle, poor lifestyle, smoking, know your cholesterol number, get up and jog, poor lifestyle. What about behavior? Well, behavior is important. It fits into my model here, but you've got to put it in a context. Behavior doesn't come from absolutely nowhere. It has to be put in a social context. And for example, if we look at smoking, I'm sure data such as these are well known to you. These are deprivation scores, and this is the prevalence of smoking by deprivation. And you can see again a stepwise relation for men and women. In the highest deprivation category, nearly 100% of women were smoking. And when we say to women, particularly single mothers with children, you really mustn't smoke, you know, it's bad for you. It's small wonder that they pay little heed to such advice. We've also been interested in diet, and looking at diet in the context of the East-West differences in Europe. For example, comparing Czech men with German men, the Czech men have a higher rate of heart disease than the German men, and we found higher homocysteine levels consistent with lower intake of folic acid in the Czech men compared with the German men. Interestingly, fibrinogen, which we think is an inflammatory marker, was also higher in the Czech than the German men. And comparing Czech men with British men, in fact, from our Whitehall 2 study, beta-carotene was low in Czech compared with British men, and tocopherol, vitamin E, was low in Czech men compared with British men. So I hadn't said much about behavior. Behavior is important, smoking, diet, other behaviors, but we need to look at them in a social context and ask, why do these unhealthy behaviors follow the social gradient? Why are there more unhealthy behaviors in the unhealthier countries of Eastern Europe compared to the healthier ones of Western Europe? Continuing my rapid Cook's tour of why or how relative position might be related to ill health, we need to consider what happens early in life. Civil servants, for example, are not randomly allocated to their positions. Oh, yeah, okay, you can become a permanent secretary and you become a messenger. They bring baggage with them from early life. And the question is, might what happens early in life have an important impact on health inequalities in later life? Development starts very early. And I put it here, but I could put it elsewhere, that in a sense, early life will affect this whole story. Let me show you one set of data that intrigues me. We've now been blessed or cursed with league tables for just about everything in Britain. We don't just have football league tables and cricket league tables. We have league tables for schools and hospitals. We'll soon have league tables for individual surgeons and physicians. These are the league tables for schools. The government publishes once a year scores on the so-called GCSE examination, which is a national standard examination taken by 15 to 16-year-olds. And what we've done here is looked at the percent of 15 to 16-year-olds passing five or more GCSEs at grade A to C level. Now, just to put it in perspective, a middle-class parent would expect their child to do probably 10 GCSEs, and if the child got five A's and five B's, the parent would say, that's not terrific. So in taking as a criterion of success five or more GCSEs at grade A to C, we're not talking about genius here. Five C's would not get you into university. You'd be talking more like about eight A's and two B's to get to university. So this is not terrific. Now, for 107 local areas in Britain, what we've done here is correlated the scores on the GCSEs from the different schools against an index of deprivation. And a high score is high deprivation. And what you can see is this remarkable straight line correlation. The higher the deprivation, the worse the performance. At the least deprived, about just under 50% get five or more A to C passes. And for the most deprived, it's about 12%. 12%. I've already described what a reasonable pass in a middle-class family would be. 12% are getting only as many as five C's. And this straight-line correlation with deprivation. Now, we're given these as if they're league tables for schools. But, of course, they're not league tables for schools. They're measures of deprivation. In social science, you never see a correlation like that. The correlation is minus 0.82. When did you last see a correlation of minus 0.82? They're measuring the same thing. This is a measure of deprivation. It's not a measure of school performance. Now, the way to measure school performance is to measure value added, taking into account background factors. But this is not it. Now, we know that educational standard predicts subsequent mortality. And people say, well, we must invest in education. I can think of almost nothing better to invest in than education. But we need to bear in mind what I said earlier in discussing rules, that further investment in education could increase inequalities in the outcome, educational performance, and could thereby increase inequalities in health, unless we take into account that educational performance is a measure of deprivation. We therefore need to interrupt that link, and it seemed to me and others that the way to interrupt that link is what happens before children get into the school system. And similarly, these are data from Doug Wilms from Canada, looking at literacy scores and looking at the social gradient by head of household. And you see this clear gradient, the higher the socioeconomic status, the higher the literacy. But I've just abstracted two provinces here. What's interesting is that the gradient is different. It seems to matter not only who your father was, but where he was. If your father was low socioeconomic status in Manitoba, you're less likely to have poor literacy than if your father was low socioeconomic status in British Columbia. And the slope's different. It seems that there's something about the environment in which people of low economic status reside, or in which children go to school, or their peers, or whatever it is about the environment, that actually changes this slope. And it seems to me it's a reasonable analogy for what we're trying to do in changing the slope of health inequalities. That slope can change. I'm not suggesting that the slope of health inequalities is necessarily directly related to the slope of education. But the fact that the slope can change depending on the context gives me optimism that we can do something about the health slope as well. And if we look internationally, there's Sweden. This is parents' education in years and youth literacy scores. There's Sweden with a very shallow gradient, Canada with a slightly steeper gradient, and the United States with a much steeper gradient. So at the upper end, there's not much to choose between a Swede, a Canadian, and an American in terms of literacy. But the lower you go down the parental education scale, the more it matters whether you were born in Sweden, Canada, or the United States. So the slope is different. And it's another part of my argument that we shouldn't just consider them the deprived, the people at the bottom, and us, everybody else. It's the slope. And I must say, I keep losing this argument. I showed data like this when the British government was, as they subsequently did, considering investing in a British form of Head Start called Sure Start. And I showed these data at a meeting in Her Majesty's Treasury and said, don't focus only on the bottom 5%, which is what they were planning to do. And the senior civil servant said, oh, don't give us that Scandinavian nonsense. We're Anglo-Saxons here. We focus on the bottom. We're not going to deal with this gradient rubbish. Take that to Sweden, he said. So I said, but what about, you know, we're not dealing just with the children of the unemployed. What about the postman's children? What about the busman's children? What about the plumber's children and the carpenter's children and the shop assistant's children? They could all be better off in terms of literacy if we could deal with the gradient question. Why are you throwing all of them on the scrap heap and only dealing with the bottom 5%? You've had the experience of hitting your head against a brick wall. I had that experience. As one example of data showing that what happens at the very beginning of life is important, this study from Kansas, where they went into households of professional families, working class, and families on welfare, and they sampled throughout the first 48 months of a child's life, and they actually estimated how many words were spoken to these children. Now, the children of the professionals, these poor kids, had 50 million words addressed at them in the first 48 months of life. It sort of explains quite a lot, really. I sort of divided 50 million by 48, so a million, no, I couldn't, a million a month, I just gabble, 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 nonstop. working class and welfare. So a striking difference. Is it any wonder these children come into the school system with different capacities to engage, to be literate, to be articulate, and then elicited a different response from teachers? Now, this was just number of words. When they looked at the quality of interaction, what they found was in the middle class parents, I don't quite see myself here, but and Alexei, but there you go. And the middle class parents were full of encouragement, and the families on welfare were full of discouragement for the children. So this starts really at the very beginning of life. And I was also intrigued in this one. There's been some suggestion, it had been known in the past, that divorce was bad for child development. The suggestion was that as divorce became more frequent, perhaps it was there was less stigma associated with it, and therefore there would be less impact on children. Well, in Britain, we've had these three national birth cohorts. There's now a fourth one, a millennium birth cohort, 1946 birth cohort, the 58 birth cohort, and 1970, and we're closely connected with these studies. And you can see that the divorce rate went up particularly between the cohort of people born in 1958 and the cohort born in 1970, went from 6.6% to 17.5%. And they looked at children's education below the median for that time, and the relative risk was essentially unchanged. Divorce was just as risky for children's development, for children's education, when it was common as when it was uncommon. And so in population attributable risk terms, it had a much bigger impact on children's education because it was more common and this, with the same relative risk. So this has a big impact on what happens to children. There have been now several studies of Romanian adoptees, of Romanian orphans. This is from Michael Ratter's study. And these were Romanian orphans, and looking at behavior problems at age six, classifying them by the age at which they were adopted into the UK. So these were children who adopted in the first 6 months of life. These were adopted 7 to 24 months of age and 25 to 42 months. And these were children who were adopted within the UK, born in the UK and adopted. And you can see that the age at which adoption happens is rather crucial. The earlier it happens, the more likely are children to develop normally. So that early life is important, and it seems like the earlier you're exposed to a good environment, the better. Many of you will know of David Barker's work. David Barker and I both served on the Acheson Inquiry, the independent inquiry into inequalities in health that I'll talk about in just a moment. And he and I began our service on this inquiry squabbling. He was essentially saying, what are you interested in all this stuff about income inequality and work environments and social environments? We know it all happened in the first year of life, and whatever happens subsequently is irrelevant. And I would say, but how could that be? You know, that we see cross-sectional effects, not cohort effects. And we'd argue, and Sir Donald said, now settle down, you chaps. We've got important work to do. And finally we got together by the end of the time, and we were talking to each other. And then he sent me a paper. In fact, I did an editorial on the paper. And this was from a study in Finland, a cohort study. And what he's got here is people's adult social class, laborers, self-employed, lower official, and higher official, and classifying them by ponderal index, thinness at birth. And so these are people who were thin at birth, less than ponderal index, less than 26, and these were the non-thin. Now, David and I are agreed that there's an interaction. We interpret this slightly differently. What I say is you can see thinness at birth only matters if you're low social class in adulthood, in terms of incident coronary disease. And he says social class in adulthood only matters if you're thin at birth. Either way, you can see there's the social class relation. It is steeper if you're thin at birth there's the thinness. It's more important if you're low social class. There's clearly an interaction between what happens early in life and what happens later. It's not all over by birth or age one, and nor does what happens later matter without regard to what happened earlier. There's a clear interaction between them. Very briefly on the sociobiological translation. In the Whitehall study, this is looking at employment grade, and we're looking at plasma fibrinogen as an acute phase protein inflammatory marker. The lower the grade, the higher the plasma fibrinogen level. Looking at the metabolic syndrome that we think is related to insulin resistance, the lower the grade, the higher the prevalence of the metabolic syndrome in men and in women. Oops, oh dear. And interestingly, coming back to the analogy that I gave you yesterday between non-human and human primates, this is HDL cholesterol in baboons, dominant and subordinate baboons, and subordinate baboons have lower levels of HDL cholesterol, and civil servants, the low grades, have lower level of HDL cholesterol. Now you can imagine what the newspapers did with this, you know, the correlation between baboons and civil servants, making a monkey out of Whitehall and so on and so forth. But it's interesting, we see similar biological effects in the non-human and the human primates. And sticking with the non-human primates, I mentioned yesterday that amongst male cynomolgus macaque monkeys, that when you mix them up in an unstable situation, you take high status monkeys from different troops and put them all together, under that unstable situation, the high status monkeys get more atherosclerosis, whereas in the stable situation, the low status monkeys get more atherosclerosis. If there's pre-treatment with a beta blocker, with propranolol, which blocks beta-sympathetic pathways, you abolish that effect, and the low-status monkeys have more atherosclerosis, suggesting the importance of beta-sympathetic pathways. Andrew Steptoe, my colleague, looking at job strain, people with high job strain and low job strain, those with high job strain had high plasma cortisol levels in the morning and then a slightly steeper drop through the day. And so a bigger drop between morning and evening cortisol levels, suggesting that the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis might also be involved. I want to end with touching on what we might do about all this. And I began the lecture by saying there is such a thing as society. And now I want to say that I think we can do something about improving it, and improving society will improve health. I think there are two basic needs that cut across cultural relativism in all societies everywhere. There's a basic need for health and autonomy, and they are linked. And that our aim should be to try and meet these basic needs for health and autonomy. Coming back to Amartya Sen, the success and economy of a society cannot be separated from the lives that members of the society are able to lead. We not only value living well and satisfactorily, but also appreciate having control over our own lives. And I think this should be an aim of public policy. Fogel says income inequality measures focus on money income that currently accounts for less than half of real consumption and which may slip to a quarter of real consumption. The most serious threats to egalitarian progress, the most intractable forms of poverty, are related to the unequal distribution of spiritual resources. And this is the challenge. What are we going to do about autonomy, control, spiritual resources, not just equalizing money? And the question is, are we going to try and improve the problem of illness in society by more healthcare or dealing at the socio-political level? Now, my view about healthcare, particularly in the United States, is that there are many people in this country who get too much healthcare, and there are many people who get not enough. The problem is maldistribution, and that is a problem that needs to be fixed, but it's not fixing that problem won't solve the problem of inequalities in health. We need to deal with socio-political factors. In Britain, we've had a series of reports, but I want to just touch on the first, the Black Report and the Acheson Report. The Black Report was set up under a Labour government in 1978, but it didn't report until 1980, by which time there was a Conservative government, and Mrs. Thatcher, who didn't believe in society, didn't believe in inequalities in health, and so she buried the report and refused to publish it. The preface to the report by the Secretary of State for Health and the introduction to it, it wasn't actually published, they're photocopied versions handed around, they're collector's items, until Penguin Books decided they could make a killing and Penguin published it. And the Secretary of State said it's disappointing that the group were unable to make greater progress in disentangling the various causes of inequalities in health. Additional expenditure on the scale suggested is quite unrealistic, quite apart from any judgment of the effectiveness of such expenditure in dealing with the problems. Therefore, we plan to implement none of the recommendations of the report. Then a new Labour government came into power in 1997 and set up, in a sense, a successor to Black 20 years later under the chairmanship of Sir Donald Acheson, a former chief medical officer. And I served on this inquiry. Just to show you one example of what we recommended and what happened, one of our key recommendations was that the tax and benefits system should be addressed to improve the living standards of those worst off. Translated, income redistribution. And this is what the Chancellor of Exchequer, the Minister for Finance, did. This is the distributional impact of major fiscal reform since 1997, so his first four budgets, by deciles of household income. The richest, as a result of his fiscal changes, the richest 10% had some small drop in income, and the lower people were, the greater the increase in income they had as a result of the Chancellor's budget. Now, this takes place against a background of increasing pre-tax income inequalities, but it does suggest that the government does have a commitment to do something about it. Now, we made 39 recommendations covering the whole of society and the whole of the life course. I'm somewhat encouraged that efforts are now taking place to do something about it. What I would say, though, is that there are at least two reasons why we want to do something about inequalities in health. The first is, if we want to improve health for the whole of society, is rather inefficient if, let's say, half aren't improving as much as the other half. So it's rather inefficient. And I would say, pursuing the inefficiency argument, it's a waste of human capital. I showed you yesterday that only one third of 15-year-old Black men in New York can expect to survive to 65. This is a waste of human capital, so it's rather inefficient. But I would say it's unjust. The reason that we want to be concerned with inequalities in health is because doing something about inequalities in health is making society a better place in which to live. I think this concern is an intensely civilizing concern, and I would say, colleagues, that you and I could do better than we have so far. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The chair is open for questions. There are microphones, I think there are microphones, on the floor. If you would use those, please.
I was wondering if I want to ask about your last comment about the inefficiency of health inequalities. It seems to me that there's an implicit argument which is commonly being referred to, although no one dares to say it explicitly, that health inequalities and other kinds of inequalities are required in order to promote greater work ethic and effort. And so, in other words, if the poor didn't see that, you know, by staying poor, their children are going to die, that would not, they would not be then encouraged to work two jobs and, you know, keep the economy running. So it seems to me one could say that, in fact, health equality is inefficient, although no one, again, no one dares to say that explicitly. But could you address that, you know, that problem?
Well, I doubt it, actually, but let me come at it at an angle and see if it gets at what you're suggesting. If you look at the recent report that Jeffrey Sachs chaired, the Macroeconomic Commission for WHO, that commission took the line, and they took the line going in, so it's not a surprise that that's what they concluded coming out, that in the developing countries of the world, one needed to invest in healthcare, he meant, to improve the economy. Now, I've actually been taking the opposite line, that health is a measure of how we're doing, economic and socially. And it seems to me it's a really very interesting dilemma. They may both be right, but they may not both be right. I've been taking the line that when I talk about a waste of human capital, I don't only mean because people die early. I mean because when people are dying early, they're dying early because they're poorly educated, they're not integrated into society, society is fragmented. There are a whole series of social problems that are leading to problems for those people. And because those people aren't properly integrated into society, it's a waste of human capital. Like I showed you the gradient in health, in literacy, that's a waste of human capital. Why should everybody not be at a literacy level where they could actually fill in a tax return? We know that both in your country and in mine, there's something like 40% of the population have difficulty with that level of literacy. Now, that's a waste of human capital. That's what I meant, and that health is a marker for that. Now, you could take the view of the Sachs Commission, which may be more true in the developing countries, that get rid of parasitic diseases and people will be more able to do a day's work, and that investing in health will improve productivity in that way.
I was struck. Please.
I think.
Okay.
This is a question about the. You made the striking case about the health inequalities have, social inequalities have health consequences. And so I guess what I'm getting at, my question is, how powerful and pervasive is that? And a way of looking at that is to see, are those at the very top of the social gradient, are they hurt by being in a high social gradient society? Or are they so happy to be on top of the social heap that it has no effect on them and they don't mind, you know, walking through the slums on the way to work, or they build walls to it, not see it, and so on and so forth? In other words, is there an argument, I guess, in part from a practical viewpoint of saying everyone is hurt? What you said is almost everyone is hurt, but we noticed in all those graphs, you know, that like they're all meeting to a point where if you make it, if you're on top, then heck, you know, like, I don't care what kind of society this is, you know, I'm on top. I'm the greatest.
Yeah, it's a very important question. When Richard Wilkinson first started doing his work on income inequality, he started to conclude that income inequality affected the health of everybody, including the best off. And that was a bit daunting and a bit challenging. I think he's withdrawn from that position somewhat now, suggesting that income inequality does not have an adverse effect on the best off. Having said that, if you look at data like those I showed yesterday from Anna Diaz-Roux, where she classified the environment into tertiles and individuals, then it looked like a high-income person was better to be in a high-income environment than in a low-income environment. It did actually seem that where you lived made a difference over and above your own individual income. Now, trying to put those two together, it may be that the very top can insulate themselves from the effect of society. But for the rest of us who are not at the very top, for those of us ranged across the gradient, it would appear that where we live has an impact as well as our own personal status. So stepping over those bodies in the street, walking past the homeless, fear of crime probably has some impact on all of us, regardless of our own personal status. I think that's what most of the data show.
Just to follow up for a moment, to the extent that's true, that those on top are at least minimally affected, it powerfully reinforces, I think, your point that of the how important social status is as such, and we can have it take place in, down here in this society, or up here in this society, or whatever. Social status is the very important factor to take into account.
Well, and it also relates to the politics of the situation, of course. I mean, that if the people at the top, who are powerful and controlling, feel they're unaffected by it, then they may have less incentive to do something about it. If they're more affected by it, then they may have more incentive to do something about it. And to the extent that they want to be a class enemy, it sort of matters. Sorry, sir. No, the gentleman.
I was struck by your identification of spiritual concerns or variables and socioeconomic or sociopolitical ones. I'm not sure that that identity is sufficiently spelled out to mark it. And adjoining that, in the light of you think that your colleagues have not perhaps paid enough attention to injustice and consequently justice, that the attribution in society of personal responsibility has tended to obscure, certainly in this society, what the social grounds are for behavior, health, ill or otherwise. And I think a model to indicate what a problem may be, and to point importantly to it, is if you think of musical chairs. That is, there are never enough chairs for people to sit down. And a plurality of households have a good income, have a happy life, have a whatever reasonably satisfied, but leaving a residue of a considerable number who are at or below subsistence, at any rate, adequately distributed services. So that the inalienable right to crap out of those folks who are inadequately served poses the problem in the light of the attribution of responsibility on the one hand and the distributive powers of a political system.
Well, just I think they're interesting comments. Just two quick comments. One is I think I for a long time have thought that there's a real difference between a political system based on individual rights and one based on responsibilities. And I think, not to caricature too much, that the American system is based very much on individual rights. A more European-based system is based more on responsibility. Now, there's been such a move over the last part of last century to say we're all by nature selfish, And there's no such thing as people taking responsibility. There's only naked self-interest. It's interesting, I was just reading an essay on Keynes, the great economist, John Maynard Keynes, pointing out that at the late Victorian Edwardian time in which he grew up, that the system only worked, and it was one of his critiques of the system, but it only worked because people didn't nakedly pursue their self-interest to quite the same extent. There was this sense that you had to delay gratification, conspicuous consumption was somewhat frowned upon, you had to save, and it was that saving that was used for investment and so on. The system worked, and this was part of Keynes' philosophy of economics, that psychology and culture were crucial. That you couldn't simply expect people to act in their self-interest, or you shouldn't expect people only to act in their naked self-interest. And that wasn't the way to try and organize a society. And to the extent that we've lapsed into thinking there is only naked self-interest, then I think we have problems.
One last question.
My impression is that in American schools of public health, there's been a move away from this approach toward more molecular approaches. And I wonder what you make of that.
Well, I mean, for me, I mean, I spend very little time right at the end talking about the sociobiological translation. For me, as somebody described what I do, is from markets to molecules. For me, it's important to understand the markets and the molecules and to go the whole way. What I would think in public health we must not do is to pursue the molecules independent of the markets. And I think it would be inappropriate for us to pursue the markets independent of the molecules. For me, we need to understand how these systems translate into pathology. But what's special about public health is its concern with the population. That's what's special about it. You know, I had a very conventional medical training, and the whole of medicine is concerned not just with individuals, but bits of individuals. What's special about public health, and as time's gone on, there are even decreasingly small bits of individuals that medicine's concerned with. What's special about public health is its concern with populations. And I've had this to-ing and fro-ing with the geneticists, for example, at University College, and where I've got to my own thinking is that I'm totally agnostic on the question of whether someday we're going to screen the population and say, you can keep smoking and you'll stop smoking. I mean, that's against the history of public health, but whether we might get to that point, perhaps. For me, the interest in understanding what might come out of the genome and better understanding of biology is the light it sheds on etiology. Of understanding biological pathways helps us to get a handle on etiology. It helps us understand causation. But I want to understand causation. The reason I want to go from markers to molecules, I want to understand causation because I want to improve public health. And I didn't think we're going to improve public health by simply adopting a clinical approach of trying to change individuals.
Thank you very much. Please remember your evaluation cards, if you will.